Hey there. You are listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening today. In today's episode, I chat with my good friend and fellow PhD student, Jeff Hubbard, about publishing journal articles. Jeff is, well, really good at it. He has published in Novum Testamentum, Journal for the Study of the New Testament, Harvard Theological Review, and four other top journals. I've talked to him probably hundreds of times about publishing, from writing the essay itself to working through the feedback from peer reviewers and everything in between. I have learned so much from him. So I thought it'd be fun for listeners to hear from him too. And more than fun, helpful. If you're working on a journal article now or hope to sometime in the future, this episode is for you. Enjoy. Jeff Hubbard, thanks for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Zen, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Would you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and about your scholarship?
Sure. First thing about myself is that I'm a longtime listener of Currents in Religion, big fan of the podcast and a big fan of Zen. Zen and I actually came into the program together, the program being Baylor's New Testament PhD. We're both in the same year in the program. We've both passed our prospectuses and are currently writing our dissertations. My dissertation is on gospel readers, the earliest readers of the Synoptic Gospels, and ancient pedagogy.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. So Jeff, I have invited you onto this podcast episode to chat about publishing journal articles. You have managed to publish an impressive amount of essays in top New Testament journals. And I think our listeners will be really interested to hear what you've learned through that kind of process. So I want to start, though, with a somewhat big picture question. When you think about a journal article, what do you think a good journal article does? Maybe like in opposition to a chapter of a book or something.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'll have to cop out and say I think that good journal articles can do a number of different things. I often find myself reading a journal article and thinking, this is a really, really good exploration of a topic that not a lot of people have discussed. It's experimental. It's getting new ideas out there in a way that are digestible and shorter, obviously, than a book. And I think those types of articles can be really valuable, where a journal article makes a contribution to a topic, to the history of ideas. It's saying, here's something that's never been said, at least in this way before. That's at least theoretically the claim of all new journal articles, is that you're making a legitimate contribution. But I love it when a journal article tries something new. It's not afraid to play with new methodologies or to throw ideas to the wall and see what sticks, so to speak. So those are the kind of journal articles I love to read. I like to write those kinds of journal articles too. And then on the other hand, you do also find journal articles that are just so thorough and so incisive that you read them and you think, I don't think the field will ever be the same after this journal article was published. And obviously those are fewer and farther between. I think probably more journal articles fall in the experimenting, throw it at the wall, see what sticks category. But it is always really fun to read an article that you just know this is going to change the field, because it's so much easier to read an article than read a book. Yeah. And you know the old cliche about how many academic books actually should have been articles.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not that's true, I'm not sure. It anecdotally, I think, has been true in my experience that when you have the ability to tighten an argument only to its most important points and present it in a really, again, incisive and compact fashion, that actually can be a very effective way of presenting an idea, more effective than packaging it as a chapter within a larger book.
Yeah. So. You're one of the few people that I know that still gets really excited when new issues of journals drop.
Well, you got to check them. I mean.
But tell me, in recent memory, what's like one essay that you just loved reading?
Oh, that is a great question. I'm pausing because I don't want to give a canned answer or something that just pops into my head as the last thing I read. Because I, you know, in my capacity as a overworked graduate student, I read a lot of articles.
Yeah.
But I do want to answer this well. That's a great question. How recent is recent?
You pick.
Okay. Well, you probably have heard me talk about this before. I'll plug a friend of mine. His name is Chris Atkins. He's doing a PhD over at Yale.
Yeah.
When we were in a seminar on the Gospel of John, he wrote just an incredible paper on the preposition pros, in John 1:1. The word was pros ton theon. That ended up being published as an article in Novum Testamentum. And it's just a really incisive, God, I've said incisive a lot. It's a really articulate and informed reinterpretation of what it means for the word in the Johannine prologue to be pros ton theon. And I don't think I'll ever read John 1:1 the same again. So
love that.
That's a big, I think, a high compliment to his scholarship that he convinced me that John 1:1 says something very different than what every English translation I've ever read in my life has told me it means.
That's awesome. Shout out to Chris Atkins.
Chris Atkins, if you're listening, buddy, I know you're probably not because you're busy and you've got two kids, but love you, man.
Okay, so I think that our listeners maybe could begin to answer some of this next question based on how you've described what a good journal article does. But what are some ways that you personally have generated ideas for your essays?
Oh, yeah. That, again, is diverse. Ideas come from multiple different venues.
Right.
You know, I think very, very early on in my scholarship days, I have he's technically a second cousin once removed by marriage, but I just call him my cousin.
That makes life much easier.
Great, and if you're listening, I love you, buddy. I know you're probably not because you're busy and have two kids, but which is true. He actually does.
Everyone in your life is very busy.
I'm busy and I have two kids.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They're very cute, by the way. John was born on August 12th, and he's wonderful.
Yeah, that's true. Vouch.
This my cousin, he says, you know, at the time he was a PhD student in coursework, and I was a graduate student just starting my MA. And I was so worried about how to develop an idea for a paper for a class.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a piece of advice that someone from his postgraduate work at Oxford gave him that was basically like, you know, maybe start by just reading the primary text that you're interested in a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm.
Develop your own opinions on it. And once you've really done that, then go read your secondary scholarship and just note every place where you disagree with what they say about the topic and the text that you've read a bunch of times. Because you're a smart person, you'll probably have areas of disagreement. You'll go, what? They think it means that?
Yeah.
It's not at all what I've gotten from that. And then, boom, you've generated a relevant topic. Now, that's not the only approach that can be taken. I think oftentimes I find starting with secondary material is quite generative. Mm-hmm. And even the distinction between primary and secondary material needs to be problematized and complicated because all we're doing is reading and writing about other texts.
You know,
whether it's ancient or modern, we're all engaged in the same kind of discursive contribution.
Yeah.
But, you know, there have definitely been times where reading a particularly good modern article or monograph has given me, you know, offers a new theory for reading one kind of text or one particular ancient text, and you think, oh, that theory could very easily be applied to this other set of texts that I know decently well, and this monograph doesn't treat those texts, so I'm going to take that person's really good theory and apply it to these texts. So, I mean, it's diverse. The starting with the primary sources is a fine piece of advice, but it can also be really generative to read other people first, because reading other people and reading secondary, in quotes, air quotes, you can't see me doing air quotes, I'm quoting around the mic, secondary sources, if you still prefer that term, that can help you generate thoughts and spark new lines of inquiry that you hadn't seen when you read the text initially.
Yeah.
It's like asking a book club, you know, so what did you think of this page? And there's silence. And then you say, well, I read on a blog that someone said X about this page. And then everyone goes, what? No, that's not what it means. And you needed that other voice to actually realize, make you realize I have an opinion on this.
Right. That's a good comparison. I'm thinking too, I think of a lot of our listeners are currently in coursework, and we're close enough still to
if that's
coursework.
True, I'm so sorry.
What I'm about to say will make you take back your apology. There have been times where we have lamented not being in coursework because of that kind of generative gift being in a room and having conversations. But it also reminds me.
I do love it.
Yeah, it is. It's life-giving in a lot of ways. It is really hard. I don't want to diminish that at all. It is incredibly difficult and grueling at times.
On the other hand, we never just sit down, just the two of us, and talk about an article anymore, do we?
That's
then?
True. We don't.
No, we don't.
We don't. We just sit and make jokes.
We
and
make
people
jokes. We talk about our kids. We should talk about an article sometime.
All right. We'll save the date. But I am thinking actually of something that beloved professor Mike Parsons once said, where he said, you always need to have a junk drawer of ideas. And he is one of the few professors that I've ever had who just sees potential in so many thoughts.
That's true. And people.
And people, absolutely, yes. But I remember in our class on rhetoric, the way that he would kind of freely say, you should write a paper on that. And it became impossible to imagine all of us writing all of the papers that he said you should write a paper on that.
Right.
Or whether it was even a good idea for us all to do that.
Made far too many suggestions that could actually be followed through on in a single semester. But, I mean, proof of his generative mind, right? He's always thinking about connections that could be made and new contributions and advancements that we could attempt.
Yeah. And I just think, for me, the idea stage is maybe the most fun because I don't feel always competent to go from idea to paper. But I remember taking that moment in class when he said, you know, you should write a paper on that. And then he said the thing about having a junk drawer of ideas so that you've always got something you can be working on. And I've now got like this little kind of note, this document.
Do you have a junk drawer?
Yeah,
a
of ideas that's
drawer?
Kind of like, hey,
good for you.
I don't even know if this could go anywhere. But at one point, my mind thought this was exciting and captivating. And I think in a similar way to reading secondary sources or something, those sorts of conversations that generate an idea that you just think about for the next hour or two can give you something to put what you read in, to give you a context for what you go on to then read about the same topic or a similar topic down the line that could turn into an idea.
Or even just sort of, to borrow a term from tabletop gaming, the concept of engine building when you're researching. So if you've got interest broadly in a topic or a set of texts, even when you're engaging on a certain research project that's not exactly related to those texts, you can be noting things. Oh, that might be relevant to this other project. I'll make a note. Right. So the more projects that you have, you know, in your junk drawer, then every time you do research, you can also be thinking, I have a project that might connect to, not for now, but for later. Yeah. And then it becomes so much easier to actually do research later because you've just expanded your base.
Your
repertoire of texts you're familiar with or methodologies you can employ, things like that, which is, you know, this is why I think it's so hard for graduate students, or at least it was for me as an early graduate student, to generate those ideas because you come into a master's program or to very on early in a PhD program in your coursework and you think, okay, by week 8, I'm expected to present an idea to a faculty member that I am claiming has the potential to be a novel contribution, but I just started the learning.
Right.
You know, I didn't have eight weeks. That's the time I had to learn before I could make, you know, meaningful contributions. And of course, there's a big difference between a seminar paper and a journal article, and maybe we'll talk about that. But, you know, I think that the reality is when you engine build a little bit, think about, okay, these are the texts that are interesting to me.
Right.
These are the methodologies that are interesting to me. Eventually, even just 2 or 3 years in, it's so much easier to generate a decent seminar paper or even a decent article.
Right.
Because you literally just know more.
Yeah, that's so true. I'm thinking, too, of some advice from that little book, How to Write a Lot. I don't know if you've ever read that book.
I don't think I have.
But the author of that book does a nice job of expanding the idea of what counts as writing. And yeah. sometimes mm-hmm. research or drafting or outlining or these other things, we should be thinking of them in some senses, if not writing itself. I mean, it is what writing depends on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the engine building metaphor that you've given is a kind of nice additional thing to include in that umbrella.
And again, everyone's got different processes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, I've seen people give the advice, not for hitting certain, not, this is not for hitting deadlines, just for the writing process in general, to, you know, just write X amount of words a day,
yeah.
even if they're bad words and you have to go back and completely delete every single one. That has not typically been how my
yeah.
process works, but I think that's because I have a treasured process of, you know, mentally or digitally annotating texts that I've read, both primary and secondary, and kind of developing an outline and schema in my head before I even touch the actual
yeah.
written portion of it. So
right.
I'm gratified to hear you graciously describe those as part of the writing process, because
yeah.
sometimes I feel, wow, I've spent so much time thinking about this. I haven't actually written anything. And, you know, here's this guy telling me I should write just 1,000 words a day, no matter
yeah.
what, if I'm ready or if they're yeah. bad or what have you. And, you know, that has not typically been how I've worked.
Yeah.
I like to keep everything up in my head and really stew on ideas until I feel like I'm ready to write,
yeah.
till it's just, you know, bursting out of my fingers.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, as you've said, that can be a version of mm-hmm. writing too, that research process can be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about the move from idea to writing for you. So you've just mentioned you live in your head for a while, you
really
annotate.
Do. Sometimes that's bad.
Well, can be, but it works for you.
It's bad when you find me stewing in the courtyard because I think all my ideas are bad and
that's
I haven't
right.
written anything.
Jeff, this is a good insight for the audience. Jeff has a period that he hits in every writing project that I've seen him complete.
Yeah.
Where he has to take
a slump.
It's a slump. He takes a walk to the Browning Armstrong Library courtyard, sits, laments how bad his ideas are, and then comes back and I think normally just basically keeps writing the same thing, but
yeah.
it ends up that it was actually a good idea all along. Just need a little despair to motivate, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the problems of doing so much of the work in your head or not putting down the ideas on paper first. Just
yeah.
you can get a little too much in your head and then you're
yeah.
like, okay, I just got to plug on and see
yeah.
where this ends up.
You are listening to Currents in Religion, and I'm speaking with Jeff Hubbard, who is a PhD student studying New Testament at Baylor University. Before we get back to our conversation, I want to tell you about a new Baylor University Press book called Theology in Many Voices, written by Amy Chilton. Amy Chilton seeks to make a place for lived experience in Western evangelical and Baptist theology. Here's a bit of the book's blurb. Theology in Many Voices presents an understanding of theology as a practice of the church, one that both makes space for lived community experience and theological content, and also provides the means necessary for encountering, engaging, and incorporating the theological insights of the global and historic church into Western theological discourse. It's an important work, and you can find a link to learn more in the episode description. All right, back to my conversation with Jeff Hubbard about publishing journal articles. So you mentioned an outline that you either do kind of mentally or that you put down on your computer. Tell us a bit about that outline. Like, what kind of detail are you putting in there? What does that look like? Or is there a normal outline for you?
I don't think there's a normal one. I think it depends on the level of research, the degree of research that I'm bringing to a particular project. The most helpful outlines are ones where I've done so much research in advance that I can bullet point each section of an argument and include which primary text and which secondary text I'm interacting with, and place, you know, and, you know, type out a, here's the main point of this section and then move on. Here's the topic of this section. Here's the people I'm going to be interacting with, both primary and secondary text. And here's the main point of this section. And then you do that two or three times and then you just write, you know, conclusion. So that's the outlines that work the best for me are the ones that are so detailed that when I come to write, I'm not writing off of nothing. I'm not even thinking, okay, what's the argument here as I move on? It's all, the process of writing for me is so much different when I can just tell I'm trying to think of the next section as I'm writing. That's when I do my worst writing. I definitely do my best writing when I've had the opportunity to think about it so much and lay out my plan and an outline, and then I can focus on the actual skills of writing out an idea well.
Yeah. And for you, writing, it sounds like you write, you don't have the mode of writing words to get words on the page. Do you labor over each sentence at the first stage, or do you ever just kind of get the ideas out and kind of come back through and revise? How does that look for you? Of course you do revisions at some point, but
yeah, I mean, you're constantly revising. I would say that my process, which, you know, is still developing, I'm still just a graduate student. The process that I found most helpful so far does typically involve so much thinking about what I'm going to write on the front end that when it comes time to write, I wouldn't say that I'm laboring over each sentence. Occasionally, tons of times, okay, word choice or phrasing, this sounds wrong. I usually try to just write the best version of an argument that the argument I've laid out that I have in my head. And then before I even really reread it carefully, I want to know what, you know, certain advisors or other trusted individuals think about it.
So this is one of my favorite features of your process, is how much openness you have to feedback at early stages. When I think, for me, I still feel unsure and I feel insecure or something about my argument or ideas. And you take that moment where you probably feel a similar feeling and are just like, well, how can I know whether this is good unless I get someone
sharing my work with others is not not motivated by insecurity.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, what? I said it's not motivated.
Oh, okay, okay, okay. Gotcha.
I share my work with people I trust because I'm insecure and I don't know how to evaluate it.
We all have our insecurities, Jay.
Exactly. I ask other people to evaluate my work for me so I don't have to, which has its pluses and minuses. But yeah, I mean, I do that mostly because, you say, being receptive to feedback. If we're talking about journal articles and trying to publish, I mean, I've had a lot of rejections from journals. I'm sure many listeners who are in the journal article writing business also have experienced that. And, you know, the biggest thing you learn is an article could get rejected for any reason.
Yeah.
So to my mind, the more people who read your drafts beforehand, they show you, as much as is possible, that many more areas or reasons why a reviewer could reject your article.
Yeah.
And, you know, why wait 4 to 6 months for it to get rejected for some reason that you could have fixed?
Bingo.
If you could have waited 2 weeks for someone you trust in your department or a colleague or whatever to say the same thing. Hey, have you considered strengthening this? Or what about this objection? So, I mean, obviously there eventually becomes a point where you could just have too many cooks in the kitchen, and it's your responsibility as an author to weigh the recommendations you get from various people.
Of course.
You know, a faculty that I love and know, like, and trust, who have given me differing opinions on a particular piece or section or what have you. And, you know, that's not their fault. That is just a snapshot of the vicissitudes of the peer review process, that people will receive your work in vastly different ways. And it's up to you at that point to decide what to do with the various criticisms and recommendations that you've received. But yeah, I mean, if you have people that you trust, people who are willing to read your work, which is something that you and I have both, I think, experienced so positively here at Baylor, is just a community of shared learning, both among faculty and among students. You know, I feel like we're constantly reading each other's drafts and sending drafts to faculty, and I mean, that's just part of being in a really collegial environment that makes it so fun to do the work, fun to write, and fun to think with other people. You know, back to missing coursework, the idea of like, you know, every 12 weeks, you guys will just share drafts of papers and you guys get to pick them apart and help each other strengthen their ideas. Yeah, that's something that happens less out of the coursework phase when you've got X amount of years basically to just write a dissertation, write a book, and you're only getting feedback from your advisors. But I find that the more people who can read my work and offer me their feedback, it's not saying, oh, I just take everything that everyone says and turn it into a big hodgepodge of an argument, but it at least makes you aware of various things that reviewers could say, and that can only help you.
Right. Yeah, I think if nothing else, just acknowledging that you, if you want to get it published, it's going to go under peer review. And so your comment, you know, why wait 4, 5, 6, in some cases more months for an initial review when if you've got some trusted folks that could read it, you could at least give yourself a better chance by having them provide a peer review, an informal peer review. Super helpful. From your experience in sending out, you mentioned rejections and things. What have you learned about the peer review process that maybe people who have never submitted an essay before might need to know, or should you think they should know?
Well, I mean, I've already mentioned, I think I used the word vicissitudes, which is...
That has been a word you've also used to comfort me about some of my rejections, yes.
Well, it happens to everyone, and, you know, when you get a poor review of your work, it can be very difficult. Obviously, it's the first thing everyone says when they describe the process of academic rejection. You know, most people give the advice to just close the laptop and not think about it for a day or two and then return to the rejection and, you know, see what's actually going to be there to help you.
Right.
So, yeah, I think when it comes to thinking about how to get work out there, the most important lesson is people have very different perspectives on our field. They have different valuations of what work is meaningful, of what methodologies are meaningful, and that can be at times very frustrating. But also, you can't really fault them for that. It's just, it is how the field operates. I mean, it's by nature a gatekeeping device, the peer review process. And so when it gatekeeps not in your favor, that can be really, really hard, but you just have to push through it. I mean, it's very easy, especially for young scholars, I think, to get a rejection and then think, well, I guess this was not worthwhile as an idea. That, in my experience, is not true. I mean, I think many people who submit good articles get them rejected from their first choice or whichever they decided to send to first, and then end up getting those same pieces, perhaps with minimal revisions or whatever, accepted at other great journals. So I think try again and again and again. I think one point, maybe it was Parsons, someone else said you should bare minimum, if you're proud of an idea and you think like, yeah, I really wanted this out, you should bare minimum try 5 journals.
Dang.
Now, if you're thinking 5 journals, at the minimum, probably a 3-month turnaround time, I mean, that's saying, you know, you've put about a year and a half potentially of investment into trying to get something published. And then if after 5 peer reviews at, you know, good journals with, you know, the intent of giving you solid feedback, it doesn't get accepted, then maybe it's time for the junk drawer, retool it in 5, 10 years or whatever your process is. So, I mean, the process of getting pieces rejected and then taking the good parts of their feedback and moving on is, I think, a really important one. Sometimes I've gotten essays rejected and the feedback has been, you know, frustratingly sparse. Those are the ones where you just say, okay, I'm just going to send this right on to the next place because you didn't give me anything helpful. Right. And sometimes I've gotten feedback that is so helpful and so articulate and offered such a thorough reading of my article or whatever that I've thought, this is amazing feedback and I don't have time to make this what this reviewer knows it could be. That was such helpful feedback. I don't know when I'll come back to this in light of that feedback because it was so good. I would be a fool to not take it. But, you know, in the busyness of coursework life and now dissertation writing life, you think, well, this is maybe not the time to return and revisit that. So that process can look a lot different. Rejection is not, it doesn't mean that an idea is bad. It can mean send it on right away, or it can mean you gained the perspective of a leader in your field who is going to really help you make the idea a lot better. And then, of course, in terms of other things, I mean, everyone learns after they've submitted a couple of articles that timelines at various journals can vary wildly. Some places have reputations for, you know, reviews that last several months into almost a year. I had an article that waited at a journal for, I think, 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that was unexpected. If you know the scuttlebutt about long journal waits, it wasn't the one you're thinking of.
Yeah.
but that's a process that can be frustrating too. I mean, if you wait a really long time for a rejection or a revise and resubmit, that's something that I think the field would be very improved if we all decided that we would take our reviewing assignments seriously and get things out, because it's frustrating to get rejected because of, you know, good reasons, or, you know, it's frustrating to get rejected, but it's even more frustrating to wait for a really long time.
Right.
Does those answer some of your questions?
Oh yeah, for sure.
What do you think? What have you learned?
Oh yeah. I have learned, a number of things. One thing is that it is incredibly helpful to get multiple people giving feedback beforehand.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, my writing process is quite a lot different from what you've described. So I write to figure out what I think. I have a hard time keeping ideas in my head and straightening them out in my head. And that can often lead, I have found in my own writing, to inconsistency in my writing, that when I'm too close to it.
Inconsistency of style or argumentation? I see.
Where I've gone off in one way at one point in the essay, and when I've returned to it, I've learned what I actually think.
Those are always fun moments. Right. What was I thinking when I wrote this introduction? Yeah, it's not what I ended up saying at all.
Yeah. The problem is that most of the time those have been invisible to me until someone pointed out that there was inconsistency because I was too close to the essay and needed someone else to read it. And truth be told, the essays that I have sent off have come from seminars where I was eager. You know, I'd worked like crazy on these papers, but I worked in haste too and had left some stones unturned. And so I remember my first review had two negative reviews from both reviewers, one of which had, the first reviewer had great comments on the content, the issues with framing, the consistency of argumentation, et cetera. And the second reviewer just basically had a lot of problems with my breezy style.
You are a breezy guy. Longtime listeners have long observed Zen's breeziness.
That's right. I've got a big breeze. And so it just pointed out to me that I had some things that I hadn't really thought about changing it from a seminar paper into a published essay. And then on another essay that I'd sent out, that it had been read by several people and by some of those people a couple of times. And the reviewers still caught really interesting and important issues that in my mind, I thought, you know, this probably doesn't need to be sorted out for this paper to be what it needs to be. But it was a challenge or an invitation to think more clearly about what I'm writing, and I appreciated that. So I've actually had a good experience with peer review. I haven't felt like I've gotten any reviews that just seem to be like person just disagreed with me or something, which I've heard stories about.
It does happen.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that I've learned that sometimes it's better to not pursue publication too hastily, and to maybe give yourself space and separation from the essay to come back to it.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
And then to send it off when you've had others looking at it. I think too, like you said, it's a gatekeeping exercise, but it's not gatekeeping in the most negative sense anyway. It's a gatekeeping exercise that I do think at its core is meant to ensure that what we write is well written and well researched. It fails miserably at that sometimes, and in many ways it can be a very unfair process, but I've had the fortunate experience of having good experiences. Wait times are, they're just a thing. and they differ at each level and for each journal. So nothing we can do about that. But
yeah, that's absolutely true. I also think that reviewers justifiably approach the review process with different perspectives and methodologies. I don't think on the surface, if you ask me, if you were going to review an article, do you think it's unreasonable to reject an article because you didn't find the argument convincing? I would think no. In some circumstances, I would think that that's a normal, valid reason to offer a rejection. And, you know, so I don't even fault people who operate that way. Yeah. If you read a piece and you thought this wasn't convincing, I understand why people reject for that reason. I think that that's the most frustrating rejection to get.
Yeah.
Because not agreeing is different than saying, well, your argument was faulty here.
Right. Or, exactly.
You know, your methodology was bad or you didn't cite the right sources or it was poorly researched. And some people, I think, are able to maintain a really strong separation of their own opinions on the substance of an argument with the, you know, the technical aspects. Was this well argued? Did it make the best possible case, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
And those are, you know, I think more reviewers like that would be great. But it's also, I don't think it's unfair to say, if I didn't agree with an essay, then I probably won't recommend it for publication. And that's, again, that brings you back to the vicissitudes because the next reviewer might agree with you.
Or might disagree with you, but think that you make a valid contribution through your argument in a way that they weren't persuaded, but others could.
Exactly. I've had reviews that have made it very clear that a reviewer is accepting it on the merits of its argumentation, but was not convinced by the essay. You know, phrases like, this makes a contribution.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take it.
Right.
If you'll take it, I'll take it. But I could tell I didn't win that particular reviewer over.
I think something else that I've learned that what you've just brought up, the maybe difference in reviewers, you know, if editorial boards are generally the folks who are responsible for doing peer review at journals, it is worthwhile to maybe look at the profiles of some of those folks and to think about how your essay could belong in that journal. Most of the New Testament journals, I think, do a great job of diversifying methodologies and the sorts of questions and things that are asked. But, you know, there's always going to be a kind of culture and ethos of these sorts of places or a kind of article that will work in one place but probably won't in another. And some of that's inside stuff that, you know, from the outside you can't really pick up on. But if you have a chance to think through who might be looking at your essay, it's worth thinking about whether they're going to be predisposed to think that it's not worthwhile or, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, just in terms of larger advice, I think that's, you know, judging fit of your article with a particular journal is a crucial first step when you're deciding where to send something.
Yeah.
In my capacity as the associate editor for Perspectives in Religious Studies, which is a journal that's operated by the NABPR, National Association of Baptist Professors in Religion, which you should submit to, by the way, dear listener. We have a very quick turnaround time. I promise to get it through reviewers very fast. I have had to, you know, politely send back to authors and say, you know, we don't have someone on our editorial board who can review
this type of
material. It's just too far outside of our purview.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that you probably can research. You can figure out, do they publish on this?
Right.
And, you know, that's obviously ultimately the editor's call. But, there's definitely research we can do on the front end to decide exactly, you know, what journal is the best fit.
Yeah.
Of course, with traditional New Testament studies, there are just a select amount of journals that really just tend to do everything if they're at the right kind of level. But even there's moods and kind of distinct identities within the field of the, I'm using air quotes again, major players, where you think, okay, this might be better suited for this major New Testament journal. This one tends to be a little bit more, what have you, experimental or not experimental or whatever.
Yeah.
Or I see this person's on their board and I take aim quite harshly at their views and they'll probably be asked to review it. So, you know, usually one only does that in retrospect. Yo, who gave me this bad review? I'm going to look up their editorial board. And of course, journals use lots of people outside of their editorial board when that's necessary. So you can never actually pinpoint exactly who gave you the bad review. Don't try to do it, even though we all have done it. Yeah, but yeah, there is a definitely a degree to which fit for an argument and an article definitely matters. Yeah.
Jeff, thank you so much for reflecting with us about your experience of publishing journal articles.
That's been a pleasure. I should stress limited experience. Someone else on here who's done a little bit more with the topic
The neat thing is we've got, you know, faculty and Baylor Press authors on here quite a lot. It's nice to hear a student's perspective, someone who's still learning the field and trying to make sense of what they can do.
Sure, very much still learning.
Any forthcoming essays that you would like to plug?
Oh, plugging. Sure. Yeah. This reminds me of the first time I published an article. My grandma told me that she was gonna she was going to buy a copy of the journal so that I got a little bit extra royalty money, and I had the sad task of informing my sweet grandma that whether or not she read it or bought it or whatever, that I would see absolutely no financial gains from whoever purchased the Harvard Theological Review that year. Yeah. but in any case, so this is simply an intellectual plug. Yeah, I had an article come out this past summer in Novum Testamentum, which is called Let the Reader Understand, Ancient Pedagogy and the Social Setting of Mark. I take a look at the author or the evangelist's command to the reader in Mark 13:14, let the reader understand, and compare that to authorial asides in school texts from the ancient world. That was a fun piece to write, kind of part of an ongoing project of mine relating the Gospels to ancient pedagogical practices. And another article in that vein is forthcoming in the Journal of Theological Studies. That one is not about Mark. It's about the preface to Luke's Gospel. It's an argument about the protreptic, the sort of propagandistic approach that Luke's preface falls into, and comparing that with other protreptics, which just has been an encouragement towards a particular way of life, which is a common feature of philosophical educational texts.
Sweet. Well, listeners, go read away at least the one that's out in Novum Testamentum, and we'll look forward to the next one. And Jeff, I'll probably just see you later, but...
That's right. I think we're actually having dinner tonight.
Oh.
Yeah, my wife just texted me that you're coming over for breakfast tacos. So,
fantastic. Okay, see you then.
All right, see you at breakfast tacos.
Thanks again to Jeff for joining in today and to you all for listening in. I hope you feel encouraged to keep writing and to keep trying to publish. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone you think might like it too. And if you haven't already, subscribe and leave us a review. These are easy ways to help others find out about this podcast. We're back next week for one more episode before we take a winter break. I hope you'll listen in again then. Until next time, take care.